So, yeah, the title of your book is If You Won't Read Them, Why Should I Write?
That's correct.
And within, you have transcribed the, let's say the diegetic dialogue from the sex tapes.
Yes.
So the title is obviously indicative of your response to contemporary literature in some extent.
In part, and also in part, a response. When the project was conceived, it was at the high brattiness moment of response to, or my perceived response to Otto's reception, where I was unhappy with how it had done.
Okay.
But then...
So when was the project conceived? Like right after its publication?
Like a month after, okay. Maybe 2 months after, in November.
Right.
I think I've said that the sales on the book have been massive peaks and then incredible lows.
Right.
And it was in the middle of a low.
Had you done any events yet at that point for Etta?
Yeah, I had done a few.
Just the LA ones?
No, I'd done the two in New York.
And had you done the one at Modern Times yet?
Yeah, I had done that. So I had done three.
Okay.
And then there was, because of the way that these things can tend to work, there were massive breaks between flurries of events, so that I had about a month to sit around being angry. Stuart Holm invited me to do Performa 11 in New York, and that was right after my event at Book Soup.
Okay.
And so, I hadn't done the event at Book Soup, and I had to fly from LA to New York, and I just sort of knew by virtue of what the structure of Performa 11 was, which was me, Ken Lark, Lynn Kerman, and then Stuart, that the three of us were essentially the warm-up for whatever sort of
spectacle,
moment of pathos that Stuart would be involved in. So I was like, well, I don't really have that much to read from, because you can't... Right here, thank you.
Is it for you?
Yes, thank you. You can't really... If you're the person that... That's...
Thank you.
Yeah. If you can't really go into those things being the least known person and expect anyone to give a shit about you.
Right.
So you sort of need an immediacy which... can be quite elusive if your most recent book is about architecture and terrorism.
Right.
So I was like, well, what can I do? And then I've been sort of thinking about the Paris Hilton sex tape, which I'm prone to do, apparently. because there's this really amazing moment in it where her and Rick Solomon, I think, is the guy, who is married to Shannon Doherty at one point, are having sex, and then, like, they're having sex and they're talking and their dialogue is really banal, but they're also watching, like, TBS at 2 a.m. and then at some point their phone rings, and I think she actually is like, I should answer my phone. It's like, well, this is like the worst of the worst.
Yeah.
You know, this is some kind of human spectacle that perhaps we wouldn't really be able to interact with at any other point in history. So maybe
right.
If I just transcribe the dialogue from that. And then when I actually went and looked at it again, it was so moronic that there wasn't anything in there. But I was like, but I know there are other tapes of Paris Hilton. And then, so I found the one where that's in the book where it's just like her in, I think, in Amsterdam, like with some dude who's like a Tommy Hilfiger model, and they're just getting high and talking to each other. And So I was like, oh wow, this is amazing. I can totally read this. And then the actual process of transcription, it's like a 3-minute video, but the actual process of transcription, because I have my own problematic hang-ups with accuracy, was like, it took a couple of hours. And I was like, God, this is just like writing. I'm just sitting here doing it. And then when I finally got the actual transcript, I was like, my God, you know, this is actually, if you put a bunch of these together, you could actually end up with something really quite interesting. And then, so then I went to Book Soup to do it, to do the event, and I met Rebecca from Penny Ante there, because she at the time was working as their events coordinator or something like that. And she and I got to get to talking, and she was like, hey, I have a press. I'm actually trying to publish things. I'm like, I have a terrible idea. We should do it. And much to her credit or infamy, she was totally into it. So that's sort of the genesis of it. Okay. Was really sort of sitting around trying to figure out what to do,
right,
to not be a huge drag on Stuart Holmes event. But then once I sort of came up with that idea, the actual conceptual possibilities related to it emerged pretty quickly.
Right. Let's talk about that.
Sure.
Because whenever I've seen you read it, you only read the transcriptions, and you, I guess once you've mentioned it, but you don't actually generally read the criminal histories that are included within the book, which beyond just the conceptual implications of the found text as it is itself, that almost gives it a, I want to say it heightens the sort of misanthropy towards that, you know, which it seems the project was generated with it to begin with. But you, at no point in the book do you have any of your own commentary thrown out, other than, I guess, perhaps, where the charts were your idea, right? Which really just, as a co-editor of the book, really just served to hammer in how completely fucking ridiculous everything is. But, so when did you decide to add the criminal history?
Actually, late in the project, when I was, at some moment, I had a eureka moment at some point between transcribing Tommy Lee and Vince Neil, when I realized that both of them were criminals. And then I started to think about, then I remembered that this actress, Rebecca Gayhart, also has a sex tape, which is kind of like the most spiritually deadening of them all. And between her and Vince Neil, that's two dead bodies. She ran over a 9-year-old, and Vince Neil got into this massive drunk driving collision where the drummer from Hanoi Rocks ended up dead.
Oh, wow.
And between them, I think they served, you know, it's like a 30-day sentence for Vince Neil, which he may or may not have served, because I could never really figure it out from the various reports on it. I think Wikipedia says he only served 15 days, but
yeah.
In any event, 30 days does not seem like a lot.
Right.
And so then, when I had that realization, I was like, oh, well, this is a really phenomenal way to sort of give gravity to this, because there's something a little light about the sex tapes, even though that there's real darkness in them anyway.
When they're kept by themselves, it's almost a lot more nihilistic.
Yeah.
Because it's really just, you know, this verbatim display of how terrible the world is.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, taking it beyond just the simple transcription, which is sort of, you know, been something that within conceptual writing has sort of come back into vogue. For instance, like, Kenneth Goldsmith just rewriting the New York Times, Kate Durbin transcribing episodes of reality television. Vanessa Place's Statements of Facts, although that probably veers closer to what actually ends up happening in the group, in terms of how it works, but It does add, you know, significantly more gravity.
Yeah.
And moves us sort of beyond just a pure conceptual exercise and into something with a natural point, you could say.
Yeah, well, that's probably the result of, I think it, in the end, it makes a better book, but it also, I think you're right, it does to a certain extent undercut a little bit of the original nihilistic intent. That probably emerges more than anything from my own insecurity. It's like, no, it has to be about something. It can't just be this. But I think the reason why, in the end, it ended up in the text beyond all of that is that there is something incredibly bizarre about living in a society where you can now buy tapes of felons fucking. You know.
Which seems like, when you put it that way, it seems like, you know, a fetish site. But
it is kind of a fetish.
Yeah.
You know, but maybe it's not a fetish. Maybe it's not a fetish if half the country has...
I thought it was almost more banalized than that.
I don't know. It's a, like, at what point does a fetish stop being a fetish if half the population
right.
has it? Then I think it just becomes part of, I don't know. But it seemed really important because it's a way of indirectly addressing why people would be interested in this stuff, which is the way that celebrity is structured, the way that you get to be famous to that degree.
Yeah.
If someone says, oh, Vince Neil has a sex tape, everyone knows who Vince Neil is.
Right.
Primarily, fame is... it's adjacent to talent. It's not what actually drives fame. Talent isn't what drives fame. It's a certain personality type. And that personality type, by virtue of the mechanisms of fame, creates an individual who lives without boundaries. And that's what people, I think, are really ultimately interested in fame. And in sort of like gossip about the lives of the famous, is that these are people who don't have the constraints that you or I,
right.
or, well, maybe not you or I, but that most people
society.
Have. And obviously, when you start racking off significant criminal histories, that's an indicator of where you really do start to bump up against the margins of accept of what the society will and won't accept.
Right.
But what's amazing about it is that because they're famous, it still doesn't work.
Right. Right?
Like the criminal justice system still doesn't work. If you ran over a 9-year-old or if you killed the dude from Hanoi Rocks, you would not be in
right. I would not be here right now.
Exactly. You'd be in San Quentin
or
wherever they put you. And so by virtue of sort of having not only the crimes they were arrested for, but also the consequences of those crimes in terms of legal punishment, it's a way of obliquely addressing how corrupting fame is, that even what should be the basic mechanism of a civil society should be sort of a monument to human civilization, which is that we've developed this
right.
idea of a justice system that doesn't work purely on vengeance and purely on like a sympathetic magic of, well, if you steal something, we'll cut off your hand.
Right.
Even that doesn't work when you're parasilting.
Right.
When you're parasilting, you just sort of have this warping field around you where everything goes haywire.
Yeah. But jumping back a little bit.
Sure.
What you were talking about there in terms of the sort of consideration of fame and celebrity and society, it strikes me actually, which I just thought of now, is that your book could almost be seen as a sort of obliquely as a sequel to Ballard's Atrocity Exhibition, in the sense that there's a demonstration of this terribly fucked up shit that's just happening, Although there's, like, similarly, there's not really direct commentary, whereas his is purely fictional, rooted in reality, yours is purely rooted in reality, and any sort of thing that's heaped on top of that is going to be more of a subjective response. So it's very Ballardian in that sense, which I think, first of all, speaks to Ballard's fucking genius and foresight towards actually the understanding of celebrity culture, especially in America, which is clearly what he was obsessed with in that book.
Right.
So, in consideration of that, I think, because, as you said, you wanted it to be have a point, I think, sort of ironically, it makes it significantly more readable. At least as, like, you know, there's the initial sort of humor and, right, like, wow, these conversations are completely banal and hilarious, and, like, these people are miserably stupid. But it gives it some sort of, it does give it a weight, which I think is almost, I think heightens the irony of the title being, as might have got cut off when we rewinded it, but
sure,
if you won't read, then why should I write? Which literally, you know, as you said, you're not writing, but transcribing. But you're still putting this weight that makes it actually readable.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's not... I mean, I'll take any comparison to Ballard that I can get. That's, But I think that's a really apt one. Not that I'd ever thought of it before, but it is pretty. Yeah, I mean, I think that Ballard is extremely good, particularly in that book, also in Crash, about where we were going. Sex tapes seem very Ballardian. They seem like he should be there scripting them somewhere.
I mean, you know,
it may also just, like I said, be a function of either my personality or insecurity, where it seems, because I definitely had that consideration when I first started doing the project, before I thought of the criminal history stuff, is like, do you really want to be the person who then puts this out into the world, because there's something so light and so insubstantial about it, and maybe that's not great. Like, maybe there's something else to do, and maybe just it won't be that interesting to read,
yeah,
because how much do people really want to lay down in a sewer? but that's also, I mean, I think, so it's actually really... It's a great question, and I guess it'll be one that'll be answered when the book comes out. One of the attractions to celebrity culture as a literary device, and which I think Ballard was really aware of, and I mean, he had the virtue of writing in a moment where there actually were iconic celebrities.
Yeah.
So that if you read his work now, you still know who Elizabeth Taylor is.
Yeah.
I mean, she's faded a little bit, but...
Well, like Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
But it is a way of writing that... I guess the best way to say it is, if there's anything like a lingua franca right now, it's celebrity gossip.
Yeah.
And so it's a way of trying to engage with the lowest common denominator of the cultural dialogue.
Yeah.
And use that as a way to try and interact with readers that perhaps you otherwise wouldn't. Because I assume, and I, you know, in a month from now we could be laughing at my naivete, but I assume that this book will do fairly well, and not necessarily with the people that small press,
right,
books necessarily do well with.
It's got a sort of inherent novelty to it, just based on what it literally is.
Yeah.
And like, you know, even the night we were at the phone booth when he gave it to me, and that friend of Jessica's came, like, she know.
Yeah.
She has no tangential connection to any sort of literary scene. And she was like, oh, this is hilarious. I should get a copy when it comes out.
Like, yeah, and I think, for better or for worse, there aren't a lot of topics that have that. If they ever did, which I don't really believe that they did, but people would make the argument that in a fractured media landscape where everything is so balkanized and there's not really a mainstream anymore, there's pockets of mainstream that might be stitched together.
Yeah.
And that you can have scenes where people's entire frame of reference, like Alt-Lit is a good one, right? Where people's entire frame of reference, at least in terms of their praxis and their friends and their aesthetic output, is all contained within the very narrow parameters of Alt-Lit. Is there a way to actually address a broad spectrum in society? And I think probably not, but I think the best chance you're going to have is if you're so low enough to write about or to interact with Kim Kardashian, then you really do have a better chance of, you know, of speaking a language that is immediately apparent in a way that if you were to write, oh, I don't know, a meditation on a lead hijacker in 9/11 in Arkansas, that perhaps you wouldn't.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up Alt-Lit, because when I very first met you, you described this to me as your Alt-Lit project. And you had considered throwing other things into it that I think ultimately would have maybe closed the project off a little and made it too specifically zeitgeist.
Yeah.
Which you ended up not including.
Yes.
You know, if you want to say what those are.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to. Because it wasn't intended actually as a slight to the people involved. I had thought that it might be really interesting to end with something from Tao Lin and Megan Boyle's NDMA. And the reason why, really, is because the first transcript of the book is Tommy Lee and Pamela Anderson working on the manuscript of a cookbook. And one of the few things that I'm genuinely uncomfortable with in this book is that if you exclude Kim Kardashian and you exclude Paris Hilton, and really, who wants to do that? But if you do, there's a very specific class element. And it may just be that there's a really specific class element in general tabloid gossip culture, where most of the people in this book were born into significantly lower middle class to actually working poor socioeconomic origins. And a lot of the humor may actually come from seeing what happens when these people are transformed into nouveau riche monsters that the entire world knows on a faint first name basis.
Right.
And so in a way that people who, if they had grown up more middle class, if they had gone to college, if they had had sort of the indoctrination and training that comes with those experiences, probably wouldn't be videotaping themselves having sex with,
right,
you know, penthouse models while they're surrounded by all the garish things that money can buy.
Yeah.
That, because there's something about taste, which taste may in the end, or at least the idea of good taste culturally, may in the end be a mechanism by which you limit your vulnerability to ridicule. And so the idea was that if you had two young American authors who were just high and like talking like idiots, that it would have a, as we all do when we're high, there'd be a real symmetry between ending with a manuscript and then, or beginning with people working on a manuscript and ending with people who probably are working on manuscripts when their MacBook is closed. And then I also thought it might go a long way to undercutting the class element. In the end, MDMA does not, perhaps to their credit, does not really have usable material. And that's kind of the only reason why I didn't put it in. Because they're mostly just sort of dumbstruck with wonderment at an ecstasy-tinged romp around Manhattan. So that was a little disappointing. But no, I mean, one of the things about Altlit, which I find really fascinating, and which I think in the end I would probably be, if I had to put it in a scale and judge it, I would probably be more negative towards than positive, is that there's a real cultural shorthand used in it, where it's, you know, you can do your self-published ebook of poems about, I don't know, Justin Bieber, right? and it seems to me, and I'm not casting aspersions at anyone in particular, but it does seem to me that there's a way to do this where you don't actually have to bother writing. Like, no one really wants to write when they're writing about Justin Bieber. They just want to have the hilarious gag of writing about Justin Bieber along with the egotistical component of having that publication out, which is me too, I think everyone, there's that really egotistical component. But it seems to me like you don't even have to do that, right? You don't, as long as you just have the form of the thing and you have the names in there, why would you spend 6 months writing this stuff, or however long it takes? It just seems like a monumental waste of time. Whereas these people are more than happy, these subjects are more than happy to generate material for you.
Right.
And then you can still put your name on it. And what's the difference?
Right.
And in the end, maybe you end up looking better for not actually doing it, for just putting your name on it. Because then, like me, you're a high conceptualist, you know? But are you really? Are you not? Who knows? But it has this level of abstraction where I guess what I'd say is I just don't understand why people would put in all that effort when there's much easier ways to achieve the same thing.
Yeah.
And also, you know, I mean, I personally would not want to be, have written something contingent upon the cultural shorthand or the signifier of Beyonce, and then 10 years from now, have no one necessarily know who Beyonce is.
Right.
When I was doing Ada, actually, all of the stuff about Walt Disney was originally just going to be stuff about Jennifer Lopez, because I was totally obsessed with Jennifer Lopez in the beginning of the 2000s and the late 90s. But I sort of had all of these reservations about it, more or less what I just was talking about. And she hadn't had her comeback yet.
Yeah.
So she was like, you know, who was... Yeah, it wasn't clear that it would make any sense. Even 5 years from publication. I mean, she seems to have reemerged. She's been doing quite a few songs with Pitbull.
Yeah.
Which, all of which are bad.
I don't know, one of them is amazing.
Oh, which one?
There's one that, when I heard it, I was honestly struck by for what is basically, you know, an empty pop song.
Mm-hmm.
There are like literally 6 different parts that are so seemingly non-related to each other that I literally found myself amazed that within this 3-minute song, so many different things were happening and it worked.
Hmm.
And it's this sort of influx of, like, you know, what the initial J-Lo oeuvre consisted of with, like, the sort of Britney Spears rave era, like Dance Until the World Ends, sort of like post-rave house influx into pop music,
along with Pitbull rapping like two lines. And
there's just all these parts. What struck me is it was like a really like, you know, like fuck what Jameson would have to say about it. But like it struck me as like a uniquely heterogeneous text. Which is like the most pretentious way to talk about pop music. But like honestly, like it was astounding to me that, you know, there's all these high ideas about the fragmented nature of culture and shit. And it's obviously what the modernists were doing in fucking turn of the goddamn century. But the fact that it's gotten to, it's been so debased that it's literally just reality, that nobody would even bat an eye, that this song makes no sense whatsoever, like, but yet it still does.
Right.
So.
Which one is it, do you remember?
I don't remember. I'm sure I got it favorited in YouTube. Which, I mean, clearly it made enough of an impression for me to just, you know, wax poetic on it for about 2 minutes. But I can't remember the fucking title.
Well, I think I've listened to at least 3 or 4 songs from her comeback.
Yeah.
And I have no idea what the names are of any of them.
Yeah.
The one with the... Oh, I can't remember who it is. There's one that's really bad. That's really, really bad. That, actually, James St. James on his blog had this giant deconstruction of it, which was amazing. But anyway,
yeah.
J-Lo seems to have torpedoed
yeah.
yet again.